Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome, everybody. It's Sunday. That means it's the main course. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. We are engineered by Joe Galarraga and intern number one. Is that right, Joe?
That's correct.
Oh, my God. Was that pause for, like, I'm annoyed with you effect?
No, it was dramatic.
It worked.
It was dramatic effect.
Is that her name, intern number one?
No, let her introduce herself.
Oh, okay.
Hi, my name is Latima Stevens.
Hello, Latima Stevens, and you are a graduate of CUNY, or a student at CUNY, and doing an internship. Well, don't touch any of the red buttons and the eject button. Carmen could get hurt. But we have a very interesting show today. We are going to start with Carmen Quagliata.
Nice job.
Thank you. Ooh, I was just told I had been pronouncing it wrong for the past 10 years. Carmen Quagliata. People always mispronounce stuff, by the way. They're like, pre-fee. I'm like, I think the X is pronounced. Foie gras, that's another one people have trouble with. I mean, there are certain words that are, and Quagliata is now added to that list. Yeah. We're going to talk all about Union Square Cafe, really one of the premier. I mean, not only is it rated number one or two or three, you know, in the very, very top tier by Zagat's, but it just also kind of is one of those restaurants for the conoscenti, people who know what good food is and the consistency of it over all these years. It is very, very special. We just ate there last night. So we're going to talk with Carmen all day. Father's Day. Happy Father's Day for everybody.
To you too.
Thank you very much. And then we're going to talk later about, we're going to have a farmer, Joseph Hubbard. But Shelley Bergman with two N's is going to do most of the talking. But we are very much looking forward to hearing about this because you are a very, very good rare goat and sheep producer in the Flint Hills.
Yes, sir.
And I'm very interested to talk with our listeners about Flint Hills because we're going to talk about it more and more and more over the years. Is that is essentially the food that the earth produces on its own in the absence of row crop agriculture.
Yes.
So it's basically free food.
Yeah.
And it exists all over the country. And if you think about animals grazing on free food like that, you remove pesticides, yes, fertilizer, all those dead zones in Gulf of Mexico, if we could restore some of the corn belt into the prairie. You know, so it's interesting to talk to a farm who's actually, whose goat and sheep are literally eating the underbrush of that prairie. Because, you know, it's probably the future of where we're going to be eating our food from.
Or as we know it, the virgin native.
The virgin native?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you call the grass?
The grass that's never been disturbed.
Oh, wow. Virgin native. Cool. That's hot. All right. Well, we're going to start with Carmen. So it's an honor to have Carmen in studio again. He's been a guest before. After spending his childhood in upstate New York, feasting on his family's traditional Italian dishes, he left the CIA, which I take it was Hyde Park.
Yes.
Where he graduated in 88. And then you worked in Napa for a while, but then you worked at Felidia.
Yes.
Who, you know, I think people know she's important, but you could probably liken her to the, you know, Alice or the Julia Child for Italian cuisine, or the Alice Waters of Italian cuisine, kind of.
Yeah, pretty much. I was always reading about her and Flitty, and I'd eaten there a few times as a traveler to New York from California. I always loved the food and got to meet her. So
she was an interesting lady. I mean, she brought olive oils and tomatoes and things like that from Italy that really hadn't really existed here so much.
Right. She didn't change the way she cooked in her restaurants.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn from that? I mean, that you take with you today? Are there certain techniques or knowledge?
Well, you know, cooking in Napa for all that time helped me. I didn't realize that when I was young, but after I traveled to Italy and then went back and kept cooking in the Napa Valley at Trevigna, I realized I was cooking as close as I could in the Italian countryside without being there. Mm-hmm. And when I moved back east and started looking around at where I wanted to work and what my next experience was, I always felt like I had to keep learning. I found that Felidia was cooking the food that was as close to an Italian chef's stove without being in Italy. Just the way they handled things, and it was much different than what I had learned, which was all very important up to that time, but just a different, nothing specific, just a broad kind of global view of Italian food was different.
And so basically you bring that, because Union Square Cafe, which is when you joined Danny Meyer's group in 2005, I mean, Union Square, I keep telling Anne this, my wife, it's an Italian restaurant, and I know it's maybe not supposed to be, but you eat kind of Italian style. You can.
I would say that that always was part of the DNA of the restaurant. And then when I got there in 2005, and after a year or two of wrapping my brain around that job, it's a restaurant that's been there for, at the time, I think 20 years. It's heavy. You know, it means a lot to a lot of people. And you just don't come in and start being yourself right away as a chef. You have to be very mature about what people love that's been there in the past and what you love. And as the years have gone on, I guess you could say it is pretty has solid Italian influences. I don't think every dish I cook is Italian, but that always it's always Italian in approach, and its simplicity and holding on to a few key ingredients. And we pretty much go to the market for our menu, not a meat or a sauce. Sorry, Patrick, but
no,
those things, you know,
it of course, is
the meat
half
we buy
a block
is important
from you.
Yeah, so that drives what we do.
Very interesting. So is that why Danny hired you? Because you had worked under Lydia Bastianich and there was an Italian character to the... Was he looking for a chef who had worked under Italian...
You know, I think it came to be by chance. Somehow they got a hold of my letter and a resume that the Union Square Hospitality Group and that company at the time was starting to go through some transition and growth. And Michael Romano, the chef and owner at the time, a chef partner with Danny, they felt like, you know, maybe this is a time to be on the lookout for some talent. And it just happened.
Very interesting.
I don't think they were recruiting me, and I just fell into it. We talked, and I cooked for them, and we talked some more. And I think it's more important in our company that we like the people.
Yeah.
You know, so we all got along. And
well, when Anna's like, they're not Italian, Patrick. And I'm like, listen, one time I showed up with Sam Edwards, the 82-year tradition cure master from Virginia.
I remember, I
brought a ham. And Carmen took that ham, you know, it was supposed to be a gift for him, but instead he helped, you know, share it, and he served it back to us, and I'm sure you shared it with your staff, too, because you're very generous that way. And I was like, and he brought out 4 or 5 improvised dishes using the ham as a key ingredient. I'm like, that's Italian, you know, versus the American, which would be, you know, not so loose, you know, and let your instincts go, maybe.
Well, I had a passion for that ham. That's really what it was. It was great. Great.
Well, you figured it out. So during Carmen's tenure, Union Square Cafe was named the second favorite New York restaurant by Zagat's from 2005 to 2007. And in 2008, it took the gold medal, probably from another Danny Meyer's restaurant, and was named the number one favorite. So, I mean, you come in and you inherit this tradition. I mean, I'm sure you've thought about it. I mean, it must be liberating and also baggage at the same time as a chef. You're responsible to so much. You have to steer it. So could you speak to the pressures of a number one Zagat-rated restaurant? That's like saying one of the number one restaurants in the world.
I mean, I never felt any pressure different than, you know, what's important to me going to work every day, and that's to find great ingredients, serve great food, teach the people around me, learn from them. I'm inspired by my job and my career. I don't really feel pressure by it. Although I understand the importance of Danny's restaurants and the legacy Union Square Cafe has.
Well, let's talk about the menu, for instance. How many dishes are just dishes that have been on since 2000, since they opened, which is when? When did Union Square exactly?
1985.
So are there certain dishes that just can't ever get taken off the menu?
No, I wouldn't say can't. It's...
Just because people love them so much. And
well, I think you respect that, the love that they have for those dishes in the restaurant. But at the same time, I'll be honest with you, some of the challenges and opportunities, actually, that we've had over the years was to decide where do we move forward and maybe apologize for some of the changes we've made or just stay close to our guests and make sure they know that you're going to love this change. And that's what's been a team effort with the front of the house. And, you know, there's probably... Let's see, there's a couple dishes that are still on. One, because it's so loved. But I think people are open to that being... We pull it on and off the menu and do some changes. That's a sandwich at lunch, and then there's a salad that's on all day that I actually really love. It's sort of like our Caesar. Mm-hmm. It's the Gruyere salad. I really enjoy it. I think it has its place on our menu. Mm-hmm. Other than that, everything's pretty much turned over. And the last big change, and it's ironic that you have Joseph here today, is we, for the first time ever, pulled the lamb chops off the menu and went to a whole lamb. You know, and I was just at that point where I just didn't want to just buy chops and not, and then sit there. I care about what happens to the rest of the animal, but I would sit there and wonder what's happening to the rest of these animals. Yeah. And so now we cook, hope to get whole lamb in 5 or 6 a week, and that happened, I think, in early March, mid-March.
And we saw that we had the Vermont was on the pappardelle, or what pasta had a lamb ragu on it?
That was the Garganelli.
Garganelli, okay, yeah. Right. Yeah. Very, very good. And that comes from a Vermont consortium. So how does that work? I wanted to ask you about your purveyors and this and that. I mean, how did you find them? Did you drive up to Vermont, or did you know one?
I worked briefly in Boston and used the same company, consortium, that was a good word. Uh-huh. And then when I came to New York, I realized we had used, the Union Square Cafe was using the same farmer with one lamb a week, and we'd always use it as a special. And I just was able to work really closely with the farmer and let him know what I did or didn't like, or rancher, sorry. We don't farm lamb, right, Joseph?
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, we ranch it.
All right.
You just become a lot more manly in my eyes. Yeah, you went from farmer to ranch.
So they were on board already, and we just continued to use them, but just increased the order by quite a bit.
And now, does that mean there's a lot more pasta sauce? I mean, one of the things.
Well, the shoulders we use in a couple different ways. Okay. And, you know, a nice ragu is one of them, with spring peas and mint, I think, is what you might have had on last night.
Because we were just talking about it. We know that if we're ever going to really help Joseph take off and not just do 20 lambs a month or 50 lambs a month, whatever it is, then he does goats and goat-tober, it's going to be a ground ragu. You know, we're thinking merguez, sausage.
Mm-hmm. Sausages.
You got to grind up the animal. And, you know, one of the things that doesn't make sense about the whole nose-to-tail movement for guys like him is, you know, if he has to wait for, you know, chefs to figure out a way to use the shank and the, you know, these really crazy cuts that are going to be very hard, he's not going to be able to sell enough lamb. Whereas in a ground form, he could maybe go through 10,000 lamb a year if he could develop a market for some value-added product. So grinding is very important for the small family farmer.
Right. And my favorite cuts of the lamb are the shoulders and the neck, to be honest with you.
Oh, the neck?
Yeah.
Why, it has a good fat content?
It's just, it's amazing. It's an amazing cut. And we bone it out of you know, off the vertebrae. And I do this dish where I roll it just with breadcrumbs and herbs and pecorino cheese like my grandmother did Bourjol when I was a kid. We just do a slow roasted lamb neck or lamb shoulder.
How much does the neck weigh, more or less?
Oh, it's probably maybe 1.5 or 2 pounds of meat.
Wow.
After we take it off.
Very, very interesting. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to come back to the menu part, Anne was noticing that the word cafe is still in Union Square. It's still a cafe, and the menu kind of reflects that everyday cafe type of vibe because it's huge. I mean, the menu has like 200 things on it.
No.
Practically. It seems like it.
25.
All the, 25, but all the, it's now, a
remember,
big menu.
Five or six are just real quick little small bites that we can get out of the kitchen real quick. There's always 8 apps. Always 7 pastas.
Oh, I see.
Always 7 or 8 entrees and 4 or 5 sides.
And then the specials.
So the bulk of the menu, what takes a lot of labor and the most important sourcing of ingredients are those 7, 7, 8 app pasta entrees.
7, 7, 8. That's an interesting
formula. Or 7, 7, 7. People have accused me of the menu getting smaller over the years.
Oh, really?
I wanted to invite them in and work for a day. See how small the kitchen is.
So 7, 8, 8. Is that how most restaurants are?
I don't know.
It seems like a little bit
big.
Yeah, just because also so many people go through the restaurant, you have the luxury of being able to move through stuff.
It depends on where you start in your life as a restaurant. When Square Cafe started, it was a much more traditional way of dining, and that's pretty much how menus were built. And when I came on board, we actually trimmed it by 1 or 2 in each category. And also, we would add some more spontaneous. Like I said, the snack things that we do are just pretty much utilization of what we have off, like the pig ears and things like that, and what we get from the market. So, and the new breed of American restaurants that, let's just say, maybe the last 8 to 9 years, like Roberta's here, or there's just a different way of building your menu and how people eat.
Right.
So you that's just influenced dining.
I think yeah, sambar. I noticed that already started to happen with David Chang, where you're like, how many dishes should I order? Like, it broke the mold of
right.
you know, appetizer.
Completely broke the mold.
So, can you speak to the state of the service provided by the small farmers of the Northeast and the Union Square Cafe? I mean, you know, Union Square Market area, because I know in the old days, farmers would, like, carry whole pigs through the restaurant, you know, and just dump them on tables. Now, supposedly, they've gotten more sophisticated.
Oh, yeah.
So how does your ordering process, for instance, work? I know with us, every Monday or Tuesday, we call around 11, we get the order, we keep calling back until we make sure that we're going to get the right thing, but...
Right.
You must work with how many purveyors, and how do you break it down, how they order process?
Oh, it's a lot. I mean, not only myself, but there's a lot of chefs and restaurants that we deal with. I would say over 20 farmers all week long in the Green Market. A couple that don't come but will deliver, like Blooming Hill Farms in upstate New York. And you just – it's a process of just staying organized as you know, the market days are coming up, Wednesday and Saturday being the most important market days. And over the last 3 or 4 years, farmers have become more and more open to getting on the phone or starting to send emails of what they have and pre-ordering.
It didn't used to be like that.
It's pretty much you go to the market and check things out, check the prices, taste the snap peas. If they're the sweetest, that's great. Get those. I mean, that still happens to some extent. I'd prefer to do that with stone fruit. I don't really order some things like that ahead. I have to be there and feel it and taste it. Does the pastry chef need it for baking? Hmm. So we'll get them sweet but a little firm. But we're a lot more organized than we were 8 years ago. And so are they. The farmers are awesome.
Interesting, yeah. Because I wish them always to be the most organized. Because if you want to really play ball, I mean, you're going to have those few hundred people come every night. So that food has to be there.
Right.
How many covers do you do a week? Or how do you judge it, a day?
Well, there's, you know, Thursday through Sunday are much busier.
Okay.
So,
lunch and dinner, or are you always busy?
We have
lunch?
Brunch on Saturday, Sunday. Let me pick a quick number here for you. 250, 255. You know, maybe a 500 covers a day, Thursday through Sunday, and that can go up. That could go up. And then Monday through Wednesday, you know, obviously less than that. But peak season, like, you know, we just finished the April, May, June is very busy. October through the New Year is really busy. Hmm. And then the off periods are, you know, the dead of winter and the dead of summer. So
that's a lot of
land. Also, we have we started doing large parties for the first time.
Oh, yeah. Now you can reserve for 12 to 14 people, right? Or 8 to 14 people.
8, 14, 15 can be, if
so
you're all
you
real
get
close
that
friends.
Upstairs?
That's as soon as you walk into the right, we cleared out some of the old furniture there and put a cool table in. And
that's smart.
Really nice, yeah.
Yeah, that's a lovely little spot. It's before you get to the bar and even before you get to the hostess stand. Right?
Yeah. And in true Danny Meyer fashion, we just hated saying no to so many people that call for large parties. And we just figured, my partner Sam and I worked on doing something so we could say yes to this. So now we can. So
very nice. Well, we're going to take a brief break. We're going to come back with Carmen and talk about the morning market meetings. And we're going to talk about his team and the Department of Health. We're going to kind of go rapid fire through the last six questions. And then we're going to talk to one of the more promising and young lamb and goat farmers in the U.S. So stay with us.
You're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Stay tuned for more from the main course.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Thank you.
Hey, Joe, who was that band?
That was Iggy Dean.
Iggy Dean? Wow.
Iggy Dean.
Yes.
She's cool. And for all our listeners, that band is... All our music is live. We always have a live band in the studio with Joe. Every time you hear music, it's a live band that cycles in.
It's getting crazy in here.
Well,
it's the house band.
I'm Patrick Martins. That's Joe Galarraga. We are the main course broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant, sponsored by Cane Vineyard. Christopher Howell, he is a sustainer of all good things back in the days of slow food. Fast forward all the way through today, being a major sponsor of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're a membership-based organization, so pay your $60 to help continue a very interesting program like we are having right now. So we're in studio with Carmen Quagliata from Union Square Cafe, the mythical, the executive chef of the mythical Union Square Cafe. We also have Joseph Hubbard and... We'll see if she'll say. The bets are out. Will Shelley Bergman with two N's say anything? Shelley, just say who you are because Joseph's already talked. You work in the beautification world.
Yes.
Of which town in Kansas?
Manhattan, Kansas.
The Little Apple,
yes.
Huh?
Yes.
And what exactly do you do? Manis, pedis, hairstyles,
yep.
All that?
All of it.
And are the nails of the farmers like super rough and stuff from doing
yeah.
all that work?
Yeah.
I always remember that scene in Dumb and Dumber, remember, when they were getting their toes cut and she was like, ring! You know, she had like a sanding machine.
Have a few of those.
Oh, brother. So, I know, Carmen, that, you know, having people together to socialize and be convivial is a big facet of Danny's work and yours. I'm always touched by how you take food to people who are in the hospital, hospice program. I mean, very, very involved, but... Amongst all that great stuff you do, you have these morning market meetings where some of your best customers can come and meet purveyors and learn about stuff they might not have known, as well as eat.
Yeah, it was a tradition that was, I don't know when it started, but before I got there, and I took to it pretty quick. I enjoy it. We just had you on. You
yeah.
To talk about that?
Yeah.
That I'm was interviewing you now. No, sorry.
Yeah, wait, what's happening here?
No, it's a lot of fun. We don't only do farmers, but we try to bring in any purveyor, you know, a guy that we always buy oysters from, or just something that people could learn about food, the food supply. We talk more about how to work with it as something to cook, but why and where, the what's and where's and why's and all that fun stuff.
Well, since this is kind of, let's have a little market meeting here. So now both of you had your first oysters.
That's true.
And I ordered both the West Coast, so they each got two West Coasts, so they would not the East Coast, or maybe too briny or something. So what did you guys think about your first... Give us your market experience with oysters last night.
Not as bad as I was expecting.
Yeah?
But I think if I would have had them in Kansas, it would have been a different experience.
Yeah? Because you would have been so far away. I mean, yeah. You guys have oysters, like fried oysters, and they come packaged, right, in
yeah.
cans, but...
Yeah. Nothing fresh.
Nothing fresh.
Nope.
So, would you do it again?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
More familiar with mountain oysters, though.
Uh-oh, what's
that? What's
that? Are we going to get punked right now? Is that,
you know
what is a mountain
You know what that is, don't you, Pat?
No, no. What's a mountain oyster?
Mountain oysters?
Yeah.
Testicles.
Testicles.
Oh,
fried testicles.
Oysters. Ah, yes. Very nice. We do need more of that. Have you,
nose to tail
a good
cooking.
Special, yeah.
That's right.
So, now, in your search... I wanted to ask you about homemade charcuterie, house-made charcuterie. I see that word thrown around a lot.
Yes.
And I don't really know. No one seems really knows what's going on. Some people, you know, make great house-made charcuterie. Others are like, they poured bleach all over my charcuterie. What am I supposed to do? You know, what is the state of the Department of Health when it comes to people who really know what they're doing, like you, trying to make nuanced, sophisticated cured meats?
Well, I think they have created some rules and laws that make it more difficult, but they're absolutely, you're able to work within those guidelines and still do the same things.
Oh, really?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's just certain documenting of what you're doing and the temperatures of the meat when you work with it, the HACCP plan, or you can do all your curing and aging under refrigeration, which is fine. That doesn't always work in every refrigerator. It's just something about the air and the humidity, but... I think, you know, it's important to serve safe food, and, you know, there's just, if you have enough passion for what you're doing, there's ways to overcome, it, but, you know, within the rules and do everything.
But would you argue that the charcuterie in New York or America is as good as that in, let's say, Spain or, you know, Italy? And why? Just because we don't have the know-how, or are there some regulations that keep that from happening?
No, I think, to me, it goes by product to product. You know, I think a great Italian prosciutto, I still don't know if I've had one better, or a Spanish ham, you know, cured. But there are, you know, certain salami and things like copa and smaller cuts of meat that people are doing here that I've had that are just as great, just as good.
Interesting. Yeah. But I guess that stereotypical hams hanging from every bar and cafe in Spain or something just doesn't, it's more a feel that it just can't exist like that. I mean.
Right. Well, I think they have a lot of years of practice and know-how.
For sure. So, okay, well, that's good. A positive one for the Department of Health.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. So, let me ask, all of the chefs of all the Danny Meyer restaurants, do you guys ever all meet together and, like, have a big dinner or cook for each other at each other's restaurants? Because these are some high-powered restaurants.
Yeah, we nothing organized. You know, we see each other at a lot of meetings. Not a lot.
Flag football.
A few meetings. That would be fun.
Capture the flag.
We did, a few years back, I had a bunch of the chefs in at Union Square Cafe, maybe after I was there a year or two. And we were going to continue to do that throughout all the restaurants in the company, but it just, I think with everyone being so busy, it never picked up. I think Daniel Hume did it first when he joined the company with 11 Madison Park.
Huh.
And then I thought that was a great idea. I was still relatively new. I think Daniel, who's now bought the restaurant with Will Gadara, Mike Anthony and myself all came at the same time.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of where the genesis of that was. Let's hey, let's all introduce each other and cook. And
it's like the it NBA was a lot of fun. Draft.
Yeah.
The class of 2002.
Within a year of each other. But
do you take all your staff out ever? You know, like, is there one day a year where you, like, fly them to Hawaii for a week or something like that?
Bits and pieces, not all at once.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Oprah does that. I think you have to be like
all
Oprah.
Right. Now you're below the belt. Oprah does it.
Oprah does it.
What's
yeah,
wrong with you, Carmen?
But it's a good. How long have some of your oldest employees been there? And I wanted to ask, what is your connection to the front of the house? I mean, what are your responsibilities, or is it the same for all of Danny's restaurants? Responsibilities of chef when it comes to the service and how the pace and style of the front of the house works. Because you guys are known for front of the house.
Right. You know, I have a partner, Sam Lipp, who is the general manager, and he's responsible for those, you know, the major duties fall into each category, the chef and the front of the house. But we work closely together.
How long has he been there?
Sam's been, oh my God, 3 years now?
Okay.
Maybe coming up in this February? No, it's got to be at least 3 years.
Okay.
I'm bad with time.
Cool.
But he's great. We sit right next to each other in an office, so there's plenty of time to rap about philosophical things and, geez, you know, if that happens, then what do we do next? Or, you know, just I think my responsibility to the front of the house is just to be able to be an open chef that can teach them as much as they need to know so they can really be on the floor with confidence and be a great conduit from the kitchen and our passions to the customer.
Very, very, very interesting. Yeah. So, and now, do you spend a lot more time in the office than you would like? I just visited my friend Bill at Minetta Tavern, and he's like, he just got to become the chef now, the head guy. And he's like, geez, I have so much stuff to do in the office.
You do. There's a lot to do. But you have to manage your time.
Yeah.
It's easy for me to take a day and say this is my plus day, and I can do whatever I want. And it's, oddly enough, I'm usually there longer than on a day that I'm scheduled just to be in the kitchen. But that's when I knock out everything that's administrative or try to have any meetings with certain cooks I want to touch base with or sous chefs or things like that. And then it frees me up to know where my mind is at the next 4 days, 4 or 5 days. So
very interesting.
Yeah, that's how I manage it. So,
and now food costs, are you always worried about food costs? I wanted to bring this back towards the lamb as a transition. Like, are you always trying to stay? I mean, the restaurant standard is what? 25%? Is that?
It depends on the restaurant. 25 to 30.
30 is the industry kind of standard.
But, of course, I'm always concerned with it. If you imagine a restaurant sells food and beverage, and the food is usually 60 to 65% of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, changing that, if you do $1 million in sales, not that this is our number, I'm just using a round number, $1 million in sales and food, 1% of that is, wait a minute. Maybe I shouldn't have picked math to do my math. Well, let's say 600, you know, it's, what's that?
Use it through the metaphor of tomatoes.
$10,000. So if you're, right? A million?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the 10,000, 1% of a million. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
10%
yeah.
is 100,000.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, good. So if you, 1 month your food cost is 30 and the next month is 28, you have to ask yourself, where'd that $20,000 worth of product in 30 wow. days go? Like, what happened? Did we price something wrong? And, you know, that's
you're so always, interesting.
That's the impact it has on your bottom line. If that is $20,000 profit.
How often do you look at that number? Once a week?
We have, we enter information every night on a spreadsheet that our obviously our finance department helps us see a running food cost.
Oh, wow.
It gives you an idea of where you're at, and then every month we do an inventory.
Wow, very, very interesting.
And the challenges have been over the years is to continue to do better food and through better ingredients and keep that cost the same or drop it.
You know? Now, have you found that using whole animals is a better food cost, or once you factor in the time of your staff and butchering? I asked that for cow, pig, lamb.
It's funny. I can change things in so many different ways in the restaurant, but somehow the staff always gets it done. It never changes the labor.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it's become better. So if I hear someone talk about, well, I can't use those ingredients because of my food cost, it's definitely manageable. We've been able to drop our food costs and use better ingredients and whole animals. If you can figure out a way to use it all,
yeah,
it's easy.
So what do you look for in lamb and goat? Because you are a big supporter of Goat-tober.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what are you looking for? Fatty, big eyes, lean taste, mild?
I don't think I want it too mild if it's lamb. I tend to try to get lamb between 45 and 55 pounds. And a lot of that is just the muscle that grows around the bone. I want to have a good yield. When we get the lamb, the type of fat cap on it tells you what it's going to be marbled as or taste like. Mm-hmm. I've learned more from people who raise lamb than butchering and eating the lamb myself. That part, the butchering and eating, comes from justifying or verifying what they've told me, that this is going to be great because.
Right.
And
so what are you trying to do, Joseph? I mean, when you know that your lamb's going to go to, you know, Union Square Cafe and good restaurants, what are you trying to do from the farm perspective?
Well, I think you can kind of gauge by knowing where your lamb's going to go, what route to take. We don't do anything with purebreds. I mean, we do, but we do a crossbred between the two to be the best of both worlds. So, like Union Square, with his information that he gave me, we would want to put something that's more dorper towards it because they're going to be a little bit more early maturing, finish out at a lighter weight, looking for a 45 to 50-pound carcass weight to meet all his needs. And then, on the other hand, if you have a butcher that wants it as big as he can get it, you know, then we'll start putting in some of that Katahdin, something that's a little bit later maturing. You get those carcasses up to 55, 65 pounds. But yet, you're still butchering these animals at the exact same age. You're still butchering at that 5 to 6 months.
Hmm. So what do you pay? You have to invest in the best Katahdins or the best Dorpers, because if you have bad genetics, all of this means nothing, right? So
Yes. You
spend a lot of money, and how do you seek them out, and what are you looking for in your breeding stock?
You kind of realize over the next few years, once you start this out, on where you're the breeders that you need to go to that are elite in their breed. So with the white Dorpers, I go to people that I've used their rams before, I've tested it out, what's going to be best for my ewe flock. Because the best way to improve your genetics is through your ram, because he's 50% of your entire herd. When you think the female, that's 50%, she's producing a whopping 20, 25 lambs in her lifetime. A ram's producing could be 300, 400, 500 lambs. So when you invest your money, you want to go more towards your rams, less towards your ewes, but you don't want to give up those characteristics that your ewes do have. So like when I'm selecting for rams, I want the best of their breed. So like my Dorper ram, he is extremely heavy, heavy muscled. I mean, these rams look like pigs walking around. They'll have that butterfly top on them. They'll have a giant hind leg.
But they're healthy, right? I mean, you don't breed for
no. Survival
of the fattest like the commodity corporations.
No, when I'm looking for rams, I don't want to look at fat. I can look through stuff that's people have overfed. I mean, you can get your hands on them. You can feel their top lines. You can tell how long their loin is, how big it is, kind of guesstimate what that eye's going to look like, what the leg's going to look like on the rail.
Now, how much of the chef's desire for a big-eyed chop has affected the lamb industry? I mean, are the best lambs producing the biggest eyes, or do the best-tasting lambs produce the smallest eyes?
I think you can have the best if you're selecting for it. I mean, if you're constantly selecting for other traits other than the eye, I think that can get to be a problem with other producers, is they select so hard for having a bigger loin eye that they forget that these ewes and their lambs aren't functional. They can't walk, they can't survive, they're not able to produce offspring. So if you take females, because you got to look at the other side of it, whatever you're producing, you're still producing replacement females to put back in the herd. So if you select only for loin eye area, that's also going into your ewe lambs. So with those ewe lambs, they can't produce, they won't breed back. I mean, you're just creating all kinds of problems.
So I have a question. Is it any safer, Carmen, I ask this to you too, to order lamb off of a menu because the chances of it being raised inhumanely are smaller? You know, because it's probably came from a smaller farm or something like that? Or, I mean, are there big evil farms for a majority of the lambs? I mean, don't they mostly come from New Zealand and they're raised pretty well? Or,
well, that's kind of the funny thing, is a lot of the lamb and goat is imported into the United States. And when you look at it, it almost has to be. But then on the other hand, the producers, the small farmers, you know, in our local area and elsewhere, our prices are affected by everything that's imported in, because they can import it in cheaper than what we can sell it. So if you're doing kind of the small thing, it's better to be in touch with Heritage Foods or the chef, and kind of have that direct market and know what you need to do to better suit them and get the word out and have that communication between producer and consumer.
So, well, when Carmen puts this goat or lamb on their menu, they're actually helping, like, fight forest fires and do all these kind of ingenious indirect things that you would not associate with eating a lamb ragu or goat ragu. But tell us about some of the cool tasks that these animals serve on the farm.
Some of the cool stuff is, and it's hard to wrap your brain around it for some people that are just set in their ways, for farmers and ranchers, but with these goats and sheep, they're not actually competing with the cattle, the horses, because they're eating different varieties of food. So you can actually do what we call companion grazing. So you'll actually graze them with the horses, with the cattle, and you can keep your stocking rates up. So the cattle are going for more of your grass species. Your sheep are going for those like weedier species, wildflowers.
Poison ivy.
They love poison ivy.
So strange.
And the goats are going for woodier species. They're going for basically the thorniest, nastiest bush you can find, and they're eating it.
That's
also
so
poison
weird.
Ivy.
The thorns?
Yeah, they pick the worst plants, the ones that every other animal would just leave alone.
Yep, exactly. So you can actually get more for the amount of land that you have by being diverse in what you produce, and that's what we're trying to do.
Wow, that's interesting.
Now, grass-fed Carmen, if his zone of the world, you know, which is the most dense coverage of tall grass prairie, which we were saying earlier is the food that the earth produces in the absence of row crop agriculture. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some farmers actually farm for this stuff, for this grass. Other times it just happens if it's untended land. Very resilient, they grow back, but it's a grass-fed thing. I have a grass-fed animal. What has your experience been with your clientele and Danny Meyer Empire and Union Square Cafe for the grass-fed issue? Does it taste as good? Do you do it if it doesn't?
You know, I think that generally the American public's palate for grass-fed beef in particular is not quite there to have like 100% grass-fed beef. And many ranchers will start on grass and finish on feed or corn feed, right?
Yes, yep.
And so that's sort of the good compromise.
Grass-fed, yeah. Corn finished.
Yep.
So when they say corn finished for beef, what are they talking, 6 weeks, 3 weeks?
I couldn't tell you the exact days. It just depends on the animal and where they're from and their breeding. So basically what we use the Flint Hills is you take in these five, six weight steers that are mainly framed, don't have a whole lot of any fat on them to speak of, and they turn them out into our Flint Hills. And what they're doing is they're just promoting frame growth. So when these cattle do come into the feedlots, that's when they can start really packing on the fat, putting the muscle in, and kind of finishing them out on a cheaper ration than what they would if they would have to put them all the way through. Hmm. So they're basically utilizing the Flint Hills as a grower.
Well, it is the future. When I say future, I probably mean like 200,000 years from now. But eventually, the topsoil is not going to be able to produce for us anymore.
Yeah.
And the next step is either going to be indoor science people like Monsanto,
yeah,
or it's going to be the earth itself.
Yeah.
So hopefully we see more people eating Flint Hills, but really anywhere tall grass prairie grows,
yeah,
tall grass prairie foods. And I don't know what the secret is, but, you know, Carmen laid the gauntlet out. It doesn't taste as good for the American palate.
Yeah.
So how can grass-fed taste, you know, like corn, you know, corn-finished? It's a real challenge. I wonder what the ideal grass mixture is, if it's even possible at all.
Well, the biggest thing is you have later, you have to select your whole different genetic makeup in your livestock if you're going to finish them out on grass. Mm. Basically what people have now are a little bit later maturing. They want it like the cattle market. They're looking for the biggest steer they can produce. I mean, weight is money. So when you're going to start making that transition to grass fed, you mean you got to look for early maturing. And what I mean by early maturing is they fatten at an earlier an age or a younger age. But even if you do strictly grass-fed beef, they're finishing out at, you know, two years old
or
later. It takes so long, yeah, to get that fat on them.
Well, very, very interesting. We could have kept talking for a while, but this show comes on after us, and we have to leave. But we could have kept on going. Carmen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank
it's
you.
Always an
always
honor,
fun.
And your restaurant is great.
Thank
it really
you.
Is.
Yes, it is.
Means a lot.
We're big fans, and we don't just say that, but you get what you pay for. And anyway, thank you very much for coming in. You guys, thank you for telling us about Manny Petty's in Kansas.
Well, and, thank you for having us.
Yeah, and I know you guys will be back on a lot. Thanks to Joe Galarraga, Cane Vineyard, and Roberta's Restaurant. We will be back with If It Doesn't Kill You with Katie Kiefer.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.